This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded land of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to the people of the Kulin Nation and all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander elders, past and present.
This is the First Time Podcast.
It's us talking writing and publishing.
Welcome to our Masters series,
where we interview Australian and international authors at the top of their games.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast.
Masters Series. Dear listeners, it is with great delight that I introduce our final surprise Masters guest of Season 5. A last-minute interview I conducted in a hotel room in Sydney, beside myself with both nerves and thrill. George Saunders is the author of 11 books, including Lincoln in the Bardo, which won the 2017 Man Booker Prize for Best Work of Fiction in English and was a finalist for the Golden Man Booker. His stories have appeared regularly in The New Yorker since 1992. The short story collection, 10th of December, was a finalist for the National Book Award and won the inaugural Folio Prize in 2013 and the Story Prize. He has received MacArthur and Guggenheim Fellowships, the Penn Malamud Prize for Excellence in the Short Story, and is a member of the American Academy of Arts and Letters and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. In 2013, Saunders was named one of the 100 most influential people in the world by Time magazine. Saunders has taught since 1997 in the creative writing program at Syracuse University. His book, based on the fiction course he teaches, A Swim in the Pond in the Rain, is much discussed on this podcast and, combined with his very popular Story Club newsletter and community, has made him one of the most lauded writers on writing today. His latest book is the short story collection, Liberation Day. It is not every Thursday morning that one gets to speak to a Booker Prize winning, Time's most influential, 100 most influential people, literary figure such as yourself, George Saunders. It is such a thrill to speak to you this morning. Thank you for joining the First Time Podcast.
The thrill is mine. As somebody who's with that guy every day, don't get too excited.
Now, you are at the end, as you have just been saying, of quite a big tour. And I know from listening to interviews with you, you quite enjoy the tour process normally. So I'm wondering if you can give straight off the top of your head the highlight of this recent tour for Liberation Day.
Oh, I think it was, there were so many, that was actually the thing is we did events with different moderators and everyone was in a slightly different flavor, which was really wonderful because you didn't know what was going to happen. There was one event in LA that Judd Apatow moderated and our daughters were there. So that was special for me because usually you're kind of doing this for, strangers that you have affection for, but no family. So that was a really special night and it was a very high energy crowd. So that was nice just to see them again. That was just sort of I was here just briefly and then went off again. So it was just one night with the two of them. And that was really fun.
That's pretty nice. I was reading your fabulous Substack. And there was one moment where I don't know what hotel you were in. And you were chilling out between events and then you just panned with your video over to a building on fire. And so I'm not sure if that was a particular curveball specifically to you, but what was the biggest curveball you were thrown on this tour?
The funny thing was, finally at 63 years old, there was no curveballs. I think often on tour, anxiety is kind of a thing, you're nervous and then you do well and then you get elated and then you can't sleep and you're all the ego things. But this time I just felt like it was maybe because of the pandemic, I just felt so appreciative. It was just like, oh, that went pretty good. Okay. And now I get to do it again. And it was all much more kind of low key. There was only one flight that was wonky and that was all right. So I think I'm just getting maybe old and indifferent enough that I just could kind of roll with it. And it was really, one fun thing after the next and kind of like gradually getting my proficiency back. Like, oh, I'm in a cab. I went out to a restaurant. Oh my God. So I had really literally no complaints. It was just a piece of cake and a pleasure from beginning to end. Weirdly, I know that sounds a little bit Pollyannish, but that really was like that.
It's lovely. Did it feel good to be connecting with readers again in a face-to-face kind of way?
So much. And I had to just to try to prolong the tour, we put some safeguards in place so that people were wearing masks in the audience and I didn't do signing. But even that was so nice. I read somewhere that neurologists are saying that we get all kinds of brain stimuli from facial cues and body language and laughter and all that. So I really literally felt part of my brain coming alive, just felt happy and kind of that kind of, you know, youthful feeling of anticipation and kind of, you know, blissful enjoyment that came back a little bit. And that was, I was glad to see that it wasn't permanently gone. You know,
I love that. I love that. And I look forward to the same thing happening. I want to go back to the beginning. That's what we do on this master's series. And if you'll indulge me, I want to ask, because I've spent the last 3 years deep in meatworks and abattoir research for my new novel. So I have to ask, please, can you set the scene for me, George Saunders, about your experience as a knuckle puller?
Yes. I was living, my mom's family is from Amarillo, Texas, up there in the panhandle. And I was living with them. I'd kind of come back from Asia and I was just kind of beatniking around. And I think I had a girlfriend in Chicago and I was just trying to get enough money to go there. And in Amarillo, the best place to do that was the slaughterhouse because you could, they'd hire anybody.
Yeah.
They paid pretty well. I think it was $10 an hour at that time. And there was no vetting and you just were getting paid almost right away. There was a really brief, very comical health and safety session you had to take. It was like, you know, you're working with sharp knives, you know. But so then I just went to work, and at that time they had this weird racial segregation where the different races worked in different parts of the thing. So I was kind of with the Mexican American guys, and we were doing the kind of heavier work, and one of the things was called knuckle pulling, and I think it was just taking a leg apart, basically, but the legs would come by like giant chicken drumsticks on hooks. And then you'd have to kind of start sidewalking to catch up to it and make all these really complicated cuts, at the end of which you had to put your whole weight on it and kind of pop something out. It's very gross. And then the really funny part was then you got your knuckle and you had to kind of pitch it across the room onto this conveyor belt. And then, you know, you just went right back in line and did it again. So I was young and it was so exhausting. I mean, you'd be out of breath within a couple of minutes and you'd stay that way for the whole shift. And then the other thing I remember is at the end of the shift, before lunch or before a break, they would speed the line up, almost like sprinting at the end of a race. So you'd be just totally exhausted by the time you went on break. And then when I went home, I know I was maybe 26 or something and in good shape. But when I would get home, after I go to bed, my hands would be stuck shut in fists. And then I'd have to kind of go over to the sink and turn the hot water on and run them there for a while. And then they'd open up. So, yeah. So
how long did you last at it?
No, not very long. I stayed there as quickly as I could get $400 or $500.
Yeah.
Maybe 2 weeks at the tops. And I just remember standing, there was a certain cage where you had to turn in all your equipment. And I just remember thinking, you know, the words of Dr. King came to mind, free at last, free at last. I don't have to do this anymore. But it was very sobering because the people who were there for the long haul, you know, people who'd gotten their girlfriends pregnant in high school maybe and didn't have any education, they were there. They're probably there now, God willing.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. They really are still there.
And there was quite a bit of tension. I mean, they kind of knew I wasn't a long timer and I caught some grief for that. But I don't blame them, you know. Mm.
Let's talk about early storytelling, George. When's the first time that you can remember seeing your words in print, whether it was as a kid at school magazine, or was it later, post your kind of engineering and other work phase?
Well, I think that the first time that felt powerful to me was, it wasn't exactly in print, but I had a high school teacher that I really loved and admired, and he would dedicate Friday afternoons to kind of a just like talking sessions, you know, the meaning of life kind of thing. So I said something in one of those classes, and he pulled me aside afterward. He said, you know, that was really interesting what you said. Would you write that out for me? I'd like to share it with some friends. And of course, he was older, and I thought, wow, they're going to be at some groovy hangout, you know, talking about my work. So I went home and very, you know, wrote it down very seriously. It wasn't much, it was maybe a paragraph, and gave it to him. And then, you know, in that school, there was kind of a feeling that the expectation was that that would be the end of it, you know. But then over the weekend, after the weekend, he came back and he said, you know, I shared that with my friends. They thought it was really interesting. They thought this, they thought that. And I just couldn't believe that I had sort of penetrated into adult culture, you know, with something I had written. And that really made a mark on me because I wanted his respect so much, you know. And then that was big. And then I think later I wrote some really terrible Khalil Gibranish poems in college, but published those under a pseudonym, like Khalil Gibran. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that was the early one. I think that was the first time that I felt that there was some power. And you know, in our family, I think Juno Diaz one time said that a writer is someone who early on figured out that language had power.
Yes.
And so in our family, it was always a big thing if a kid could sit at the adult table and be entertaining, tell a joke or tell a story, participate in some way. But they didn't suffer a fool lightly. You know, if you were being obnoxious, they'd send you away. So there was some sense that if you could hold your own verbally, you could be older than you were, which I thought. How about you? What was your experience?
Oh, I was absolutely the poet, you know, the scribbler at school, and got all of my that early validation from having other people read it and say, this is a good story. But interesting that you say about that setup of like around the table, whether that storytelling was kind of also an oral tradition for you and your family, or were you also scribbling down, you know, journals and
really
things like
wasn't.
That?
Actually, I don't think so. I think it was more, you know, for me, that time was kind of melded with that renaissance of stand-up in the 70s, from George Carlin and Monty Python. So one of the things you could do at school to get some credibility is memorize those routines. And of course, that wasn't easy because they'd just be on once on Sunday night or SNL. Yeah. And then the other kind of, you know, high watermark was if you could, imitate your mother or a teacher, but higher than that was if you could invent somebody and then inhabit that personality. Yes. So we did a lot of that, strangely. And years later, I finally made the obvious connection that that's literature, you know, to imaginatively inhabit some made up person.
Yeah.
So that was speaking of the first book, that's what I realized was, oh, dummy, there's a connection between how you're naturally entertaining and the way you might write a whole book, you know.
Yes, because there's a sense, and in interviews and in things you've talked about, you had this working life and then you went on to go and do your MA at Syracuse. And you've talked about this idea of kind of trying to inhabit Hemingway into that space and then finally kind of realizing where your own voice was. Tell us a little bit about what that experience was like at Syracuse as a student.
Well, I think early on, you know, as a working class person, I had maybe too much respect for literature. I thought it was the thing that one couldn't quite do, you know.
Yes.
So Hemingway was a big hero. Also, you know, Steinbeck, kind of the modernist I like. Yeah. And so I didn't, you know, I hadn't made any connection between actual communication and that work. So I just thought, well, I should just sound like that, you know, and have the same aspirations that they seem to have. So go out and live and then describe it in laconic, understated sentences. And so, but not surprisingly, I couldn't get any power doing that. I mean, my life, the intersection between Hemingway's trout fishing in Spain life and mine was absolutely zero. You know, I was living in Texas or Colorado, and my family was having some financial struggle. So, and then Paul and I got married and we were having some financial issues and I was working in a corporation. So that doesn't exactly lend itself to Nick Adams, you know?
Yeah.
So really the big breakthrough was just to go, oh, writing is not a sort of superior performance, you know, me doing something and you going, oh, George, that's great. Mm. But it's actually communication. So it's the two of us putting our heads together over common things that we share. Mm. And then I thought, oh, I've been doing that my whole life. I whenever I go somewhere, my first impulse is to make a tension lessening joke, you know. So that kind of connection, to suddenly see that as literary, was a big deal, you know. And what I tell my students is if you are a person who's keeping a certain power out of your work in this way, you know, which a lot of, not every writer does, but many do.
Yeah.
Their conceptions about literature are making a kind of a wall that's keeping their real talent out of the room. If you're somebody like that, one of the things to watch for is when you're looking at a draft, do you have strong opinions about it? Mm. You know, when I was writing Hemingway, I would just be like, I don't know. I have no idea. I my only basis was to say, well, does it sound like that book over there? You know, so that's pretty weak, you know, weak stuff. Mm. But when I was starting to write funny, I totally knew what was funny. And I totally knew what was fast and what was energetic. So then suddenly, what a relief, you know, to look at a line of your prose and go, oh, God, I know what to do with that shit. You know, it's not nothing lofty about it. It's just deciding and reacting, really reacting. You know?
What gave you the kick? What gave you the kick to leave the Hemingway-esque behind?
Repetitive failing. Really. I mean, there was so, I mean, I just kept kind of going, oh, I'll try this. And then it would fail. And I'd say, oh, well, I just need to make a slight adjustment. Makes a slight adjustment, it would fail. And actually, when I tracked back through it, there were two things that happened. One was my best friend came to town and he read some new work. And he said, pretty frankly, you know, I think you have never written as well as you did when you tried to get into the MFA. And there was one piece, one 4 or 5 page piece that was really funny and had some resemblance to my work now. But I abandoned that right away. He said, no, the work you've done since then wasn't as good. And that hurt. I mean, oh my God, what a heartbreak. Yeah. And then at about the same time, I had written one more attempt at it was more imitating Joyce, I think, or something, but it was this big novel. And I gave it to my wife and it was, you know, quite a bit of work for me. I mean, a couple of years of staying up late and getting up early and all that. And her reaction was just, I joke about it now, but her reaction was just to put her head down. And like, I watched her read the first, she was about page 7, you know, and she just had her hand on her head. And she's like, oh my God, what is this crap? And there's 400 pages or 500 pages left, you know, 600 pages. So just seeing her in that posture. And then, you know, that feeling like when you've written something, you can construct a kind of a justification. Well, but sometimes that justification just yields. And in this case, I went, yeah, it's crap. I know it is. I've known it for a long time, but I couldn't quit. So that was that feeling of hitting rock bottom. Like I've got no more rationales left. I give, you know. And in that moment of true despair and almost like I was almost laughing at myself, like, well, all right, maybe this isn't supposed to happen for you. Then I went into work and I just was doing these little comic kind of pornographic poems, you know, just for during a conference call. And then I brought those home and she responded to them without me even asking. She got a big laugh out of it. And the light went on that, you know, the you ignore your reader at your cost, you know, at your peril. Yeah.
You really do. So there was a few big pieces that you had published. Was it during the MFA before your first collection, Civil War Land in Bad Decline, came out? How did that all happen? Because the first time podcast listeners are so interested in how you make that move from being the writer at home to getting out there into the world.
Of course. Yeah, of course. Well, I had published three pieces in very small journals before I went to the MFA. And one of those pieces was the one that got me in. I got in, I chickened out. I just thought, I actually said to Toby Wolf, I'm going to write real literature now. None of this goofy sci-fi, you know.
And what did Wolf say?
He looked at me very skeptically and he said, well, good. Don't lose the magic, which then I proceeded to do for the next 7 years. But then coming out of that, I wrote, I actually, with this new realization about being entertaining, I just basically did a knockoff of that earlier piece, you know, kind of said, okay, let me just make a different theme park. You know, and that piece got accepted pretty quickly at a small journal. And then I can't remember the exact order, but I was always sending stuff to the New Yorker. In those days, you sent it by mail, you know. And so somewhere in there, I got the proverbial nice rejection, which was, you know, 3 or 4 lines. We can't use this, but it's got some power. Please send us something else. So I was so excited. And I made a mistake of showing it to my boss. And he said, yeah. George, man, we noticed you've been using the copiers for your and he actually used the phrase for your literary thingies. So that was deeply humiliating, but it also made me go, all right, well, you just gave me a grant for the arts there, pal. But so I was writing at work mostly. We had 2 babies at home by this point, and I'm sending stuff out. The New Yorker said maybe. I sent them another one, they said maybe, but not this one. And then the third one, I was up actually at an army base doing some field work for this geological company or environmental company. And I got accepted while I was up there. I knew it was pending.
What was the moment like?
Well, we came back from about a 12-hour day in the field and we were investigating environmental contamination. And I came back to the hotel and there was a kind of a garbled, very Chekhovian, a kind of garbled message that the receptionist had taken at the hotel. So it was one of those microtels. And she said something like, New Yorker will take, or something like that. You know, it's from my wife. So that was great. And so this guy I was with, we went out and had some steaks and had too much beer. And then when I came home, actually the really sweet thing was Paula, my wife, who had met in writing school.
Yes.
She took the kids around to 6 or 7 doctor's offices and collected New Yorker covers. And then she made this beautiful banner, almost like Tibetan prayer flag.
Oh.
And then she made a cake and we had a big celebration. So that was a life-changing moment. I mean, to be in that magazine really kicks you up to a different level. I got an agent from that, and then, you know, what at least in those days, once you got an agent, you the wait time was cut down dramatically. You know, you get answers quickly. And I got two pretty quick acceptances from Harper's in the next couple of months. And so then suddenly you're into the light. You're somebody who has a book deal maybe, or, you know, so that was a big deal for sure.
Lots of people.
Still working.
As one must. Yeah. Lots of people I speak to talk about that. You know, that first moment, it's not necessarily the biggest deal they ever get, nor the biggest book, but that first moment is the one that's unforgettable. Yes. Is that what it is for you?
Oh, I remember going out. Actually, this is the very first story that got accepted in a small magazine, and they paid $50 or something, if that much. But I remember taking the dog for a walk, and we were living in this town on the Erie Canal, and just sitting in the grass, and the feeling was, damn, I it's real. You know, nobody can take away from me that I'm now a published author. Mm. And that it just infused my whole life with a different feeling, you know, instead of being somebody who was kind of in the work mode, living the wrong life, I was just living an outer life, and the inner life had been validated, you know, and it was so sweet. And it was just, I mean, that's a very holy feeling, because it wasn't about money and nobody was going to read that thing. Nobody, I mean, I don't think anybody read it that I know of. I did. but it wasn't that. It was that I had entered that lineage, you know, of people whose words had been deemed good enough for print, you know, and that was just incredibly cheering. It just literally cast a different light on everything. Any hardships I had, well, I'm a writer having a hardship. You know?
Yeah. Those words, I am a writer. They are so powerful. You've now gone on to and still do teach at Syracuse since 97. And, you know, we famously hear that you take 6 applications from, you know, something like 700 every year. And I want to ask, what are you looking for in those 6? What are the qualities you're looking for?
I can say I don't do that reading anymore. I think 3 or 4 years ago, I weaseled out of it. Oh, yeah. No, and it was kind of a beautiful, we do it every February or January, February. And it was kind of a, you know, you dreaded it. And then it was really interesting. It was a chance to kind of lower yourself into this vast pool of fiction that ranged all over the place. And what happened was you started to remember what you treasured about it or what you valued. So you're reading to reject and you're reading fast. And every so often something would come along that you couldn't deny. And it would be like after reading 30, where you're like, yeah, pretty good, pretty good, pretty good. Cause they're all pretty good. And then you get to one that just stops you and you're reading for pleasure and you don't care how long it takes and you want to meet the person and you know, so, it was a great way to, for example, see what everybody does, you know, the common moves that any writer will do. And you think, well, so actually part of our job is to not do that, you know, maybe. Arguably, that part of the job is to not phone anything in, you know, not just do this, the description of the living room because you're in the living room, or, you know, part of your job is to reside with your work long enough to take it in a direction that's slightly new or surprising. And at that pace, you're kind of ruthless. You know, at first you think, oh, this isn't so good, but maybe it gets better at the end, or I'll have to excuse this boring section. But after you're reading you know, 200 or 300, you're like, I'm sorry, I have to be ruthless and really admit what I like. And then the other weird kind of mysterious thing about it was, so, you know, I'd read 100 or 200, and then my colleagues would also be reading separate piles. Then we'd come together, cross read the sort of semi-finalists. But when we got to the end, there was no disagreement about which 15 or say we wanted to have in mind. Almost never, you know, sometimes it'd be a little jockeying for position, but so I think to make a long answer shorter, what you're looking for, I think, is some kind of human being on the other side of the page who isn't just dancing, you know, isn't just trying to check off the boxes or show how smart she is, but is somehow hungry to make a connection with you as a human being. And you can feel that. And and in fact, you can't look away from it when it happens, you know? So when I first started, it was very anxiety provoking. What if I picked the wrong person? What if I miss somebody? And after 20 years of doing it, you're like, I'm not going to miss anybody. That's like, you know, what if I'm meant to have love at first sight and I miss it? You won't. That's why it's love at first sight. So same with the manuscripts, you know, I'm not sorry to not be doing it, but I am a little bit, because it was like a purifier every winter, you know.
There's a great, I think the word you've used to describe it is a great tenderness between you and your students. And one of the things that you've written or spoken that I've listened to many times was with Cheryl Strayed on sugar calling at the start of the pandemic, when you read out a letter to your students. And it was so beautiful. And we were deep in lockdown in Melbourne at that time. And there was a real tenderness, as I said, and trust that your students would get through it. And that as writers, one of the skills they had was to pay attention to what was happening around them. And that would be something that would help get them through. What was that period like for you? What did you learn about what you need for writing, what you need from the world during that kind of horrendous period of lockdown?
Yeah. Well, at the beginning, I was kind of giddy. I couldn't believe it was happening. It seemed like, like sci-fi, and it also seemed it would be over quickly, which so I our lives are pretty monastic anyway. We were living up in Northern California, and we're way up in the woods. So in a certain sense, it didn't change much. But I remember being really frustrated, is too small of a word, but to be living that life and be on TV seeing how much suffering was going, nightmare suffering, and go, not only can you not do anything about it, you shouldn't go out, you know, that your part of it is to stay home. That was an interesting, powerless kind of feeling. Kind of like, I guess it's a little bit like when someone you love dies, you just say, I have no power in this. I don't want it to be happening, and no one's asking me, you know, and it's happening just the same. So there was that. And at the same time, it was just sort of myopically, I canceled all travel and only that way realized how much time and energy that had been taking. So now I'm just home, and we're home every day. And Paul and I are both writers, and we cranked, you know, and I also noticed how much I was going to that for sustenance. You know, I'd be so sad and frustrated and confused, and I just go up and work. And I'm on that Russian book at Swim in a Pond in the Rain. And just that, it wasn't like I was coming up with any solutions at all. I wasn't even thinking about that. But that process, as you know, your monkey mind has to go quiet because you're working, you know? And so the rumination goes down. And after 3 or 4 hours of that, you just feel better. You know, you feel better. So I know, I just noticed that, maybe in that vacuum, I noticed it more than ever before, how much my mental health and positive attitude depends on having some time alone like that every day.
How did your students go, George?
Well, I only teach in the fall now. So I think that when it first started happening, I wasn't teaching. And then the following fall, we were actually up in New York State, and we did it all by Zoom. And it was, again, I think it was very nice for us to be together that way, even though we couldn't be in person. Yeah. But we do the 3-hour workshop on Zoom, and then an hour long phone call with the people whose work was up. And so I thought, it just made me realize how much we need that stuff. I mean, it's not joking around to say we need other people.
Yeah. Hunger, an absolute hunger for it.
Yes.
I want to ask about an interview that you did with Michael Williams for the Sydney Writers Festival back in 2017. I love Michael. And I have listened, I kid you not, I've listened to that podcast recording so many times, and I have gone back to listen to it so that I get this right, this quote. And what you said is, one model I love for a work of fiction is that it exists perfectly in your mind before you start. Then you go to tell it and you drop it, and it shatters all over the floor, and you think, ah, shit, now I have to rewrite it. So in a sense, you are reassembling a crossword puzzle. And what struck me then, and I think that I published my first book the year before that, but that idea that it exists perfectly has really sustained me through the writing of my next two, because there's this deep trust then. And why I went back to check is that I tell that anecdote that you told, and I always end up describing it as this kind of glass orb. And I realized you didn't say that at all in that interview, but that's how I've pictured it in my mind, this like beautiful, fragile, astonishing glass orb that you drop and shatter, and then you put it back together.
I imagine it as glass, but maybe a flat disc. And then I noticed in the quote, I meant jigsaw puzzle, not crossword puzzle.
So tell me about that trust. The trust that you have that the work exists wholly in another form before you even begin to try and articulate it.
Sure. I think that, you know, that metaphor, like all metaphors about writing, they're not true, but unless they're helpful.
Yes.
So for me, that's helpful, because when I get into the thicket of some story that isn't behaving itself, I don't have to say I'm a failure, I'm an imposter, I've lost my mojo. I just say, oh, this is broken into a lot of pieces, and it's going to take some time to, but I had total faith that it existed perfectly. Now, I don't mean that I could have gotten at it at that point. Yeah. You can't, yeah. It's in your deep subconscious, but then you think, okay, well, if in fact somebody took your very valuable orb and broke it, and you were given the job of putting it back together, and if you did, it would be wonderful and you would be acclaimed or whatever your dream is, you know, and there's no time limit. Well, of course you can do that. Yeah. It's just a matter of looking under every couch and discarding pieces that are from a different orb and so on. So it's sort of like when I was in engineering school, I heard this great thing about geology. It said, given infinite time, anything can happen. So that says to you, you're not on a futile or a vain quest. You're just on a quest. Mm. And I've seen that proven out so many times where, you know, for example, in this new book, there's a story called Mom of Bold Action. And yeah. The opening section actually got into the wrong orb. It was in a story called 10th of December for a while. And it didn't fit. So I popped it out. No problem. It's just in the wrong orb. And I waited. And then the new orb kind of formed around it. So it's just a way. It's a way of kind of bolstering one's patience, I think. The faith. It's like, yeah, you know, you don't have to beat up on yourself if something is going badly. It's just a difficult orb. And, you know, your subconscious is taking some time to reassemble it. You know?
In that idea of, you know, given infinite time, anything can happen. You've often talked about this idea that the story ends up being a little smarter, a little kinder than you are as the writer. And I wanted to ask, have you ever had the experience of a story getting too smart for you, outsmarting you?
Well, it depends. I mean, if that's a positive thing, yes. You know, it just leapt into something I didn't see coming. Yes. I mean, actually, I was just talking in Spain, they just are releasing Fox 8, that little book. And there's a really violent moment in it. It's kind of a kid's story, kind of sweet. And then this really violent thing happens. And I remember in that moment, I went, oh, boy, I actually didn't want that to happen, you know. And the story said, well, you know, you want to make me worse by taking it out? I said, no, I don't. And the story said, do you want to rise to the occasion here? You know, would you allow that your book just got reformulated? Like, I guess I have to. So I was like, yeah, dummy, you know. So then I don't remember exactly how it came out, but it just came out so naturally. And then when I read it, I was like, oh, shit, that's a horrible thing happening to a perfectly innocent being. I don't know if I want that. But then the story says, does that ever happen in the world? Like, yeah, okay. So you just wrote, you know, I always quote that. I think it's Einstein, but it's really not. But it's no worthy problem is ever solved in the plane of its original conception. Mm-hmm. So that was the story saying, your original conception is boring me. How about this? You know, and then at that point, that's the painful moment when the story becomes smarter than you.
Yeah.
And you're saying, please don't, please. I don't.
Don't go
I
there.
And it says, all right, be mediocre. Go ahead. Yeah. Go back to what you had, you know.
it's so very painful. I have my very well-thumbed copy here of A Swim in the Pond in the Rain. And my most well-thumbed section is Afterthought 2, which we talk about a lot on the podcast. And this idea of intuitive iteration and that going back an infinite time. Can you just, because I have tried to explain this to people before on the podcast and probably made a hack of it. Can you please tell us, George Saunders, about your idea of intuitive iteration?
I will. Although let me also say parenthetically, I know for a fact it's not for everybody. You know, one of the problems with that kind of a book is it seems to be a formula, but it's just mine. It's just
mine. Of course.
So I offer to my students always with the caveat that take as little or as much of this as you want. It might not apply. I'm sure it didn't apply to Dickens, for example. He doesn't seem to have been an iterator, you know, not much. Yeah. So having said that, basically it's the idea that you cough up some draft. And that should just be kind of for fun. For me, it's not the whole story. Usually it's just a little bit, a little sec, even a paragraph. Yeah. Then you just start worrying it. In the positive sense, like, oh, I wonder if I could make that sound better. Or now this is where your personal taste comes in, because maybe for you that means funnier. Maybe it means it sounds better. Maybe it means whatever it means to you, that, you know, you have to steer by your own lights. So you mess with that section. And for me at that point, I'm trying to keep all ideas out of it, you know, ideas of theme or intention or what the next thing is. I'd try to have not think about that. I'm just trying to make the prose be the best version of itself I can manage by ear, mostly for me. Then if you do that, at some point, the word I always think of is undeniable. Like I want that section to be undeniable. If it is, it will produce kind of an ambient question or a moment of potential energy. Like I've said this thing, therefore the next beat should be this thing. And you feel it. You don't, you know, then you start writing that. And then you just do that over and over again. So the progress of a work of fiction is sometimes hundreds of passes, maybe even thousands sometimes. And all you're really trying to do with each pass is make very small adjustments or sometimes big adjustments, but micro decisions that you're just making at speed for fun. Blah, 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 blah. You put it in, you print it out, do it again and again and again. And my experience has been if you do that, that allows all kinds of revision, big, small, rearranging everything. And in a sense, you're trying to increase the energy, I guess I would say. But again, you have to use your own phrases, whatever, you know. Then slowly the thing will start to assume a shape that doesn't feel like it's coming from your conscious mind. And it sounds a little mystical, but really it's kind of the practice of just reacting to what you have. And it has the anxiety reducing flavor of saying, forget the muse, just react, you know, just see how you like it, you know? And I like this approach, one, because it works for me, but also because it does take your anxiety down. You don't have to be an expert on all literature. You don't have to have a theory about genre. You don't have to have an intention. You just have to have the thing that all writers are born with, which is an instinctive strong reaction to language. You know, we drive by a billboard. Ah, it's got a commas place. Yeah. That's what you're using, actually, you know. And this is maybe the one thing in life where you can use it just the way you want. You don't have to explain it. You know, you can be the most powerful person in the world. Just do what you like. And then that's the theory. So, but now there's all kinds of roadblocks. I mean, some people don't, especially early on, they don't really know which light to steer by. You know, they don't really know. So for me, I was trying to sound like Hemingway. That didn't work. Trying to be funny, that method works. So part of this is all very personalized because you, the writer, has to supply the decisions and the taste and the judgment and all that stuff. And that's that nobody can help you with. I don't think.
There's a lovely idea. You use the word kindness a lot and this idea of coming at your own work as a reader with kind of good intentions. One of our wonderful writers, Charlotte Wood, talks about, you know, coming to a writing session with this kind of slight optimism, which is the same kind of thing that I read in that way of reading back over your own work. Do you think that kind of quietening that self-loathing voice, that critical voice that we have in our head, is something that you just get with experience? You just have to practice that?
Well, also, it may not be the best. You know, for I'm sure some writers have a great time. I mean, I use it for sure. You know, you write a first draft and like you're gonna destroy your reputation, you know, loser. So I think it's maybe for me, it's a little bit like having a number of hats. You know, the hat that loves your own work, the hat that hates your own work. So you're kind of rotating those in and out to get the I think also there's an element of what your attitude is towards your perceived reader. So that's also, you know, when I was young and I would go on the road and there'd be eight people out there, I'd be standing backstage going, they're going to hate this, you know. All right. Then when we talked earlier about interacting with people, with audience, after a while, after enough signing lines, you go, well, they actually came out because they like it, you know. Yeah. So that changes your mind about things. And so in this way of thinking, revision is sort of slightly optimistic faith that you could engage these people who you've engaged before. That's not so hard, you know?
Yeah.
Or even on the revision level, I think you sometimes think about, you know, who's this reader? She's really smart and she's really lived and she's really, kindly inclined towards me, but she's no sucker. She's, you know, she wants to be respected. You start writing to that person. And, you know, I was just thinking the other day, for me, this is maybe too personal, but when I was a kid, I had all in Texas, I had all these girl cousins that I adored. They were all a little older than me, most of them. And I would go there, and I was the only grandson, so I was always this little pasha, you know. Mm-hmm. And I loved being charming with them. I loved that they would like me, and that I could be tell jokes, and they would like me. So for that 2-week vacation, I got a, you know, an artificial boost in my likability. And I think that's a lot of when I imagine readers, I'm imagining people who I'm entertaining in that way, trying to make myself more beloved to them. But sometimes to do that, you have to be a little naughty. You have to say something outrageous, you know?
Yeah.
So I think all of these things are valid. But again, it's not, you know, one size doesn't fit all. And but I do think most writers, younger writers, they put obstructions in their way that have to do with over-controlling phenomenon. Mm-hmm. So what should I write about? I want my writing to be morally upright. I don't want, you know, this whole list of things. And a common, you know, reason for writer's block is you've got so many questions, so many boxes to check that you can never get started.
Yeah.
And I find it sad when I see that, you know, or when someone has got talent, but they can't start. Mm-hmm. So at Syracuse, we talk a lot about having the talent for having talent, or having the talent for having your talent. And that's innately, I think, a psychological thing, a game that you have to play with oneself, you know, mm-hmm. How can I talk to myself so I get the best results out of myself? Mm. You know, something like that.
One of the unexpected, I mean, our listeners know that we've recommended this book so many times, I don't need to go on about it, but one of the unexpected things for me,
ahead.
and I hadn't read a lot of the Russians before I did it, was the understanding of translation. And I actually did a wonderful interview with an Australian translator, Stephanie Smee, who did the English translation of Joseph Pontou's On the Line, about, you know, working in abattoirs and fish factories. And she and I just talked about your ideas about translation in the book, but also that amazing translation exercise at the end that you invite writers to do. And you talk about translators as stylists and stylists as translators. What kind of muscle are you asking writers to exercise with that translation kind of?
I think it's a musical muscle.
Yeah.
You know, because if we agree that there's a cat and a black table and a knife, and the cat skitters across the table and knocks the knife off the table. Say, we agree on that. We pick that up in the foreign version.
Yeah.
Well, then the job is all music. How do we arrange that image charmingly? Mm. And of course, then you say, well, define charm. And I say, exactly. You know, So I think a proper translator is trying to imitate the tone of the original. But if you and I are working on two different stories in which that thing with the cat happens, there's no limit, there's no compunction, so we then get to say whatever we want to say. And so the key to who we are as stylists is in how we arrange the words, you know. Maybe you do a David Foster Wallace thing and you write three pages on it, or maybe I do a Isaac Bobble and I do it all in one phrase, but that's it. I mean, and really I think I feel that that's really what people are turning to writers for, is that moment when a little bit of reality gets expressed quicker than we expect, and it comes to life more vividly in our head than it should be able to. And that's all style, you know.
Okay, let's get on to your incredible new collection, Liberation Day. And I've been listening to some interviews with you about this, and the word fun and the word playfulness, the word humor, you've used a lot already in this conversation, come up. And despite the fact, so it's 9 stories, and they range from this kind of dark dystopia to beautiful contemporary work realism kind of situations, to the gorgeous love letter to a grandson. But there is this sense of fun in each of them, even when they are heartbreaking and dark. Where did your intent for the whole collection come? Or did it just kind of, okay, this is these stories from now, these are the ones that I have, and I'm going to pop them together?
Yeah, my collections are usually just, I start and then I can kind of, it's almost like there's an aesthetic assumption that's in place. It's from inside my heart, really. Mm-hmm. And I just write per that assumption. And then it starts to die off a little bit. Or not die off, but just become, I don't know, it starts to wear out. And then I'm like, okay, I got one or two more stories. And then I'm out of this book. And I mean, maybe coincidentally, that's always when I get about 130 pages. I'm like, oh, I just need 70 more. I'm done. but there's some feeling of like, okay, we've been thinking about the story this way. And then I'll be rereading them as a collection and feel like, where does the other foot want to come down with these last few stories? And then again, not trying not to articulate it, but just feel it. And then at some point I'm like, okay, I think that's it. And on this one, I got to that point, and then I added one story, the very last one, very late in the game, because it felt like there was a little foot that wanted to come down off that last foot.
Nice.
So it's again very intuitive, all just as intuitive as the writing of the stories as the picking and the ordering and all of that kind of thing. And the assumption is whatever your deep mind was on about during that period, it'll come out. But I, you know, the tour is always interesting because I don't really know yet. I don't, I'm done with it. And I'm still like, I don't know. I have to read that again. You know, you have to talk about it, but it's, you know,
I want to start by talking about Brenda in A Thing at Work, which is a story that kind of continues your delight in writing about work and in writing class and social hierarchy and the moral kind of failings we have as humans. Brenda cannot win. She can't win in the system that she is working in. Can you tell us a little bit about Brenda and where the heart of this story is for you?
Yeah. So Brenda was not the person I worked with, but similar to a person I worked with. And she, at that time, you know, she was a typist and she came to work and then very nice person. And then she disappeared for a few weeks. And it turns out she'd been in jail for bouncing some checks. And then she came back very sweetly and apologetically. And in real life, that was it. But I just was always struck by that. I knew this person had a pretty difficult home life. And so just kind of struck by the way that she went through that, came back. And I guess we consider ourselves fairly benevolent for not making a big thing about it and taking her back. But meanwhile, she had to go through all the shit that we were going through. Plus, she had this thing hang over her head and was ashamed of it. So that idea just lingered with me. And I used that to kind of graft on a whole different person than that woman. But yeah, and in that mysterious process, it just became so much about what it's like to be at the bottom. And, you know, you have, that's what it just, you know, all the various problems of that.
It certainly, of all of the stories, and like this is an incredible range of stories that ask and invite the reader to feel so many things. And in all of them, that was the one that I kind of had those visceral reactions of anger and deep connection and empathy. Yeah. Such an incredible character.
Thank you. It was kind of an experiment because it's a little, I mean, for me, it's a little muted. It doesn't, the voices are somewhat realistic, not quite, but somewhat. And so it was kind of an experiment to see if I muted that, would something else come up, you know, to compensate? And I hope it did.
In Love Letter, which is another beautiful story, a letter from a grandfather to his grandson in a not so distant future, it's kind of a deeply political story. And it reminded me very much of a video I saw recently of the writer Kim Stanley Robinson kind of pitching forward into the future and reflecting on the 2020s and the 2030s and how kind of radically imagining how we might get through them. And it struck me that being able to pitch forward like that and reflect on the kind of moment we're in allows for, you know, it invites us to try and make some kind of meaning from it as well.
Yeah.
How, if at all, did writing this story help you through the moment that we're in?
Well, because at first it was just me feeling frustrated with the news and going up to my shed and just venting a little bit, you know, trying to say, why is it that I feel this is the end of democracy? And actually I was doing jigsaw puzzles literally at that time with my wife. I'm like, what's going on? So it was just kind of a vent really, you know, and then you know how sometimes you can vent, and if you attribute it to somebody else, and it's not venting, it's fiction. So as long as you then react to your own venting in a way that isn't just, you know, simple. So I just had him vent a little bit, and then noticed over the course of the rewriting that he was kind of talking himself out of the position he had at the beginning. He first tells his grandson to keep his head down and forget about politics and don't be involved, but just be safe. And then I think by the end of that, he's kind of starting to change his mind. So in my sort of taxonomy of the story, if you can perceive even a little change, that makes it a story. So that was enough. I didn't have to go much beyond that point.
You lean deeply into this kind of dystopian spec fic world. You return again to the idea of theme parks, which has been kind of hot material for you. Do you find more delight or more possibility in writing into those speculative kind of world building where you're really going radically out there? Or do you find the same delight in each story?
It's a little different. What I like about those worlds is that, you know, way back in the day, the first theme park story was kind of a way to get out of that Hemingway thing.
Yeah.
You know, if you use a simple objective diction, but you're in the Virgin Mary theme park or something, it just reads differently, and you're a comedian all of a sudden. So that was an old habit. I like the way it frees up the language a little bit. You know, it's supposed to sound goofy, and that in turn means that my plot seeking apparatus gets confused. You know, I don't really know. I don't, if I'm writing in a realistic mode, I tend to be kind of methodical, I think, and a little bit kind of boring, actually. You know, there's something about, well, what should happen next? But with that language, the things happen before you realize they're happening as you seek voice. And that I really like. You know, sometimes you just like with that story, Ghoul, I was like, what is this about? Why are they kicking people to death? I don't like that. You know, I don't know what to do with it. It seems a little Stalinist or something. But because you've written yourself into that, you then have to write your way out. And that's where this model of the orb comes into play, because you say, well, my subconscious is trying to tell me something, and she's making it rather difficult, but she has a plan, so just stick with it, you know. So I just like that voice as a destabilizer of my whatever my sort of tacit late middle-aged ideas are. That voice is like an ornery 17-year-old who goes, oh, that's stupid. You know, let's do this instead, you know.
That's really interesting, because my next question was actually about that idea that voice and language and interesting language and strange vernaculars is so much part of some of the stories in Liberation Day, mm-hmm. that asking whether or not the voice comes first or the story or the plot comes first was my next question. But obviously that happens in different ways for different stories.
It does, but mostly it's the voice comes first on the stories I really like, because then right away I don't know what's happening. You know, in this book, I think the only one that had an idea, God forbid, was the very last one, Home, mm-hmm. and it was, or how my house. Mm-hmm. And it was just one that I carried around a little widget of a person goes to buy a house, and there's a personal misunderstanding with the seller, and the thing that should happen doesn't. That was kind mm-hmm. of the little, and that just came to me in a flash as I was mm-hmm. driving one day. So that mm-hmm. was the only one. But generally, I really like to keep the ideas at bay as long as possible, because they're going to come in anyway. But if they come in organically, it's going to be more natural. I always imagine, like, I'm huddled over the desk, obsessing with language and fun and humor. And then ideas and themes are like these little forest creatures that are like quietly coming out of the woods behind me. But if I turn to look at them, they'll either run away or they'll get really stupid and literal, you know? So you keep your attention on the language or whatever it is for you. And then those things, of course, they're going to come in, because you know, if I have a narrative that compels you to finish it, you're going to get a theme. And I don't have to know what it is, and you don't have to know what it is, but you're going to get it anyway.
And I feel like I can't possibly let you go without asking you about success, which is something that we ask lots of our authors about on the podcast.
I'm for it.
I mean, so are we all. And, you know, your first and only novel so far, Lincoln in the Bardo, the incredible Lincoln in the Bardo, won the Booker. So, you know, I do figure you have something to say on this. One of the wonderful writers that we talk to, the Australian writer Christos Tolkis, talks about the idea that he didn't anticipate how greedy success would make him for more and how destabilizing that was for him and for his approach to his writing for a time. And so I wanted to ask about how success over your period as a writer has maybe shifted, if it has at all, your approach to your own writing.
Yeah, that's really wise. That's a really wise observation. I think the overall arc would be best thought about in terms of motivation. So early on, desperate for any attention, for power, for a place in the world that wasn't, you know, that had some power to it, really was for me, especially with a young family and a big ego. And then slowly over time, I think that, although with some bumps, it dissipates. And at the end, you're at a point where you just want to do something really good. You've gotten your share of that. Now, I'm not there yet, but I can kind of feel this last pass, like, oh, yeah, so I'm familiar with a good review. I'm familiar with a happy audience. I love that. And yet I'm still hungry for something that isn't that. And so that's a healthy thing. And also, I talk to my students about how I think we should be quite positive with our own ambition. You know, it takes so much energy to write a book. I mean, to write even one book, so many false starts and obstructions and all that. So I think we have to kind of use whatever energy we actually have. And if it's the energy of you know, as Dr. Seuss says, what do I say? Fame. I'll be famous as famous can be with the whole wide world watching me win on TV. You know, if that's the motivation, all right, go ahead. Because what can happen is those motivations that might be a little skanky can be purified, you know, over time. And it's just energy. It's just energy. You know, if fantasizing yourself at the Academy Awards gets you to
that's
the
actually
table,
one of mine. So,
I mean, of course, you know. Everybody, yeah. And the beautiful speech you make that's better than everyone else's speech.
Yes.
You know? So if that's, and also you look great because you're, you know, but that I think within the realm of the intense fantasy universe that we inhabit as writers, I think it's okay to use that stuff. I think it's totally fine. It's just for fun, you know. Now, the problem is that at some point when you get success, it starts, it's like a sugar buzz. You know, you want more and more and it's empty, but you don't know it's empty because you're addicted. That can definitely happen. And you know, one thing that will protect you is good manners. I know there have been times when my ego was positively raging with self-importance, but I have good manners, so I knew to hide it. That doesn't mean it wasn't happening, and that's, the ego is so crafty like that, you know. It'll and then I would be when 10th of December came out, I was collecting praise for how evenly I was accepting it, but my ego went, oh, look at that, you're pretty cool, you know. So yeah. There's an endless cycle. But I think, for me, and this is again in terms of anxiety reduction, I like to just say, you know, whatever is happening is happening. I'm hungry for fame. Okay, what do you want to do with that? Do you want to just indulge it mindlessly? No, I don't. Okay, you want to interrogate it a little bit? You want to maybe extract out the parts you can use and reject the parts that you can't, with the aspiration that someday you'll be free of it? That makes more sense to me, you know. So I think, and I think too, it is kind of like anything that's acquisitive in nature. As you get more of it, you can theoretically start to need it less. And I felt that this last time on the tour, like, yeah, that was fun, but the question that's really burning in me is, can I do something really good still? That's the, you know, so try to feed that idea.
Well, we look forward to the next really good thing. George, let me ask about Story Club just briefly, your Substack newsletter and enormous kind of community that you've built. One of the questions I have to ask is that you're prolific on there. Like there's so much. Sometimes I've got messages kind of lined up for me to read on a, you know, an evening when
That's
I have
annoying,
some time. But I want to ask, you know, there's this sense that Saunders doesn't need to do this. His book, you know, he's on the Late Show. His book, he could write whatever he wants. He doesn't need to do this. He's teaching. What's the compulsion for this sharing and this giving and this building of a community? And practically, how are you managing it?
Yeah. Well, the second question is, I haven't really been writing full time in the last year. I was writing some screenplays and doing revisions to this book. So we're going to find out if I'm still prolific in Story Club once I get another book. And then honestly, you know, they came to me with quite a nice financial offer a year ago. Yeah. And I thought, well, God, okay, that's a lot. Okay, yeah. I'll try it. A little skeptical because it's basically social media adjacent, I guess, you know.
Yeah.
And then once I started it, it's a natural outgrowth of my teaching, which I really genuinely love. And it's part of this ego thing. I like being a good teacher. I love the feeling of being helpful or being praised for teaching. I like that too. Mm-hmm. Preferably both at once, you're helpful and praised.
Yes.
And then this community started forming, which was a shocker. And the tone of it was just so positive and so helpful and nurturing. And I was learning so much reading the comments, and I was kind of shocked by how high the level of comments was. Mm. So really it just became a system where the more I put into it, the more I'm getting out of it. Mm. And when I went on the road, there was always a good third of the crowd was Story Club. And
wow.
So I just feel like, you know, we've collectively stepped into something really fun and positive. And so I want to hold up my part in it, you know, and not disappoint anybody and not let it be, you can go on autopilot. So I'm really grateful for it. I didn't expect it would be so much fun at all. Not at all.
One of the things that happens is that people write in with questions. And there was a gorgeous one recently, a writer who was worried about the well-being of their writer friend. And the very beautiful kind of response that you made, which reminded me so much of Cheryl Strayed's Write Like a Motherfucker, which I have, you know, printed up. I know lots of writers do. And one of the things that you write is, or you advise, maybe, even if you're not actively writing because you are too busy, you are still a writer because of the way you regard the world with curiosity and interest and some sort of love. No need then to declare that one is or is not a writer. You just are because of how you think. And one of the things that comes into us a lot, especially from emerging writers who are, you know, so desperate to get published and have that validation, is that they have this kind of falling out of love with writing. Mm-hmm. And I want to ask how you advise people to fall back in love with writing if they're falling out of love with it.
That's a tough one, because I know that myself, when I was at that point, if someone said to me, just write for the heck of it, I'd be like, no. Mm. I want a book. So we have to be realistic to say that many people really do crave the validation, and the pleasure of writing is tied in with the validation, which isn't so unholy, because it means they want to communicate something and they want an audience. So that, I think we have to say that's true. Mm. For me, the most useful thing that happened to me was I realized and then accepted the truth that time spent is not necessarily related to productivity. So, you know, when I was working at that office job, I could not get 4 hours a day. I couldn't get an hour a day. So the temptation is to wilt. Oh, the world has denied me my vocation. The higher path is to say, well, it's the world has made it more difficult. But what if I grant myself a special dispensation to be incredibly productive in the 6 minutes that I have, you know, or the 15 or whatever I can steal? I think the subconscious is kind of like a beautiful puppy. It will actually follow you around. And if you say, you know, subconscious, we're going to drop our demand for 4 hours a day, the subconscious goes, okay, yeah, all right. And we say, okay. And also, by the way, it's very possible that we could make significant progress on our book if we just could grab 10 minutes a day. The subconscious goes, all right, let's do that. You know? So then suddenly your productivity isn't anybody's business but your own. You can decide, you know. That helped me a lot, because there were days when there was no way I was getting writing time. And I could either have a good day or a bad day, you know. And I said, okay, this is just a skip day, or it's a day on which the well is filling up, you know. So, but I have to be careful, because I have my evolving persona is cheerleader for the arts, you know. Yeah. And I do believe that, but underneath it, there's a sort of more, well, maybe as honest voice saying, yeah, but. All of this being true, some people don't get published. We have to admit that. There's a skill, there's a talent. But the thing is, we can't know if we have the talent unless we do the craft. That's the basis of it. So we kind of, I suppose it's a bit like getting married. You say, well, I don't know if this is going to be a 60-year marriage, but I can't find out unless I go into it with good relational hygiene, you know, and try to be a good partner. So I think that's the thing. First, try the craft. And part of high level craft, I think, is actually the admission that it might not work. You know, if you go into it saying, I'm going to do this craft because I know for sure it'll produce a book, you're not really in it. Right. Yeah. So you have to kind of say, I might be a fuck up. It might be a fuck up.
Yeah.
Okay. That's right. That's why we work so hard, you know, something like that. But I'm cheerleading again. So,
well, as cheerleader, I have to ask the last two questions that we always ask as part of the podcast the first one is about advice. And I know that, I mean, people can read any of your books, your Substack, any of your interviews for your advice. But I want to ask, when you are put on the spot to say, well, what's the advice that you most give to your students and to other writers? What is that piece of advice, George Saunders?
It's very mundane, which is just get in touch with how you revise. Because without that, you're just in a terrible trap, which is you want to be a writer, but you've made it all dependent on your first draft. And then you're unless you're some kind of mad first draft genius, and I don't really know any of those, you're stuck. So then your job becomes, all right, how do I improve something? And that seems to me like a vastly beautiful land, to be in the land of improving things, that you can always do that. So I think that's it. And in my experience, that's a real difference between people who go on to publish and who don't. If you get into a real adult relationship with revision, all hope is never lost. You know, you can. And whereas I have some students in the past who would write these big novels, bring them in the workshop, get some very helpful critiques, then jettison that novel and start another one. So they're in an infinite loop. They're writing the same book with the same defects over and over again. That's a nightmare. So I think just, you know, recognize that we can make something better even by 2%. if you look at it and cross some things out. You know, 2% over 20 iterations is quite a lot, you know. So that would be, that's really just learn to revise and don't be afraid of it, you know, and to really revise, not just, you know, surface, but really go deep with it, I think.
George Saunders, can I ask you to please recommend a debut book, anytime, any genre, a first book that has spoken to you?
The Bible? No. God never followed it up. No, actually, I have one. I had a student back in the early 2000s named Salvador Plasencia, and he was a little younger than his group. And he was in the same class with Cheryl Strayed, actually. They were in the same workshop, and they were kind of briefly like amiable nemesis, if that's even a word. So Cheryl, of course, is Cheryl, and she has this beautiful, realistic worldview in her fiction, too. And Sal was a little younger, I think a little edgier, and he was very much a postmodernist. And so they got into, you know, in workshop, a couple little scuffs, like, you should be more realistic, you should be, you know. They ended up being great friends and really helpful to each other. But Sal had a book, and so the layout was, if you imagine a book open on a table, there were, I think, three columns on the left side and three on the right, and each one was a different character's point of view.
Wow.
So you had to read it sort of with a wide eye, you know, down the page. Yeah. And then the last column was, you found out, was the omniscient narrator.
Huh.
And at some point, the characters in the book recognize that they're being narrated omnisciently and they don't like it. So it turns out that an omniscient narrator can be stopped with a lead roof. So they make a, you know, so then when they're in that place, that column goes dark. It was so crazy.
Oh,
so crazy.
Wow.
And in the early drafts, he brought it to workshop, and we all were very sober, like, well, Sal, you're quite a good writer, but this format is too confusing. No one can follow it. And he's the youngest in the group. Yes, okay, no, I understand. I'm just playing with it. I'm okay. But meanwhile, concentrate on the content of the individual columns, arrange it like a regular book. Okay, next workshop, he brings in the same format. It's a little awkward. You're like, Sal, as we said last time. So this wonderful guy, he just kept nodding and placating us, and he never changed it, and he published it, and it's a wonderful book called The People of Paper, and it was published in 2005 by McSweeney's, and it's just kind of a masterpiece. And and it was just, I always think about that, because I was so sure that that wouldn't work. And at that point, I'm 50 and I'm got all these books out and I'm a professor, and he's 22 and he's like, nope, I know what I like, you know. But also, he took, especially I think, Cheryl's opinion, because there was maybe in the early drafts there was a sense that he was hiding behind the gimmick a bit. Yeah. So he said, okay, and he went in and revised each one of those columns as meticulously as anyone ever could in the sort of realist mode. So he had it both ways. He had a really radical, beautiful experiment going on that was written as beautifully as a standard book, you know, and it still holds up, I think.
Wow. I'm going to go and seek that out. What a joyous story to go with that recommendation. George Saunders, I have to tell you, you have been top of my interview wish list for some time now, and it has just been an absolute delight to speak with you.
I didn't know it until now, but you were at the top of my list too. Let me see it. It was so much fun.
Thank you so much, and good luck with the next work. And we just thank you for all that you give to the lit and the writing world, because it's so helpful and so generous, and you are so tender with all of us. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I had a great time.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.